Good evening and welcome to Radio EduTalk. This is David Noble and Dalgetty B as ever, and welcome to the first in the series of shows for the new school session. And this evening I'm delighted to welcome Danny Murphy from the University of Edinburgh. Good evening, Danny.
Good evening, David. Hi.
And we're going to be talking about a text that I think was published this June that you were one of the editors of, Everyone's Future, Lessons from 50 Years of Scottish Comprehensive Schooling. Just to start off with, though, Danny, could you give us a kind of brief background to your career in education and academia?
Yeah, I'll make it brief, and particularly in relation to the book. I mean, I'd worked for most of my career in Scottish comprehensive schools, laterally as a head teacher. And I was quite keen when I retired or went into semi-retirement, I'm still working a wee bit part-time at the University of Edinburgh. I was quite keen to mark this 50th anniversary of Scottish comprehensive schooling. It was on the 27th of October 1965. The then Secretary of State for Scotland sent a message around all the local authorities telling them to abolish selection at age 11. And that's been a very significant moment for Scotland. And in these 50 years, we've seen Scotland change a great deal. Now, the way that Scotland has changed has influenced how schools work, but also I would argue, and we argue in the book, that the way that society is in Scotland has also changed, at least in part because of the character of our schooling system. And it's something we've come to take for granted, really. The national debate, which was in 2003, told us that by and large people in Scotland are pretty happy with our comprehensive schooling system, which is a big contrast to what there is south of the border with such frenetic, constant change in our secondary schooling system there in England. And I wanted us in Scotland to find some way of marking that anniversary and taking a big system-wide rain check on whether we've managed to fulfil what the original vision of comprehensive schooling was, which is really a very democratic vision, that our schooling system will deliver individual empowerment so that people have more liberty and freedom to make choices in their lives, that it will deliver greater equality, so that people in the country are treated and have a more equal position, and that we deliver a greater, well, I'll use an old-fashioned word for this because I think people recognise the word, despite the kind of paternalist overtones to it, that the schooling system would deliver greater fraternity, i.e. that people learn how to live and get on with each other despite their differences. So these three big democratic principles, liberty, equality and fraternity, I think underpin the comprehensive schooling system. And the book aims to tell the story, which is a really interesting story, I think, of those 50 years, all the ups and downs, the policy switches and changes, Michael Forsyth, the influence of politics, all those things, and then ask the question, now, where have we got to? And then the next question, of course, is, and on the back of that, where do we want to go next? So I'm very pleased we got the book to a final publication stage. I was joined in working on the book by three experts from the university who've done so much research over a whole generation into our secondary schooling system, Linda Croxford, Cathy House and David Rafe. Professor Rafe unfortunately died earlier this year just before the book was published, but his contribution is there right through the whole book. So that's the background to me in the book, David. It's out there now for people to read, and we've got a big conference coming up actually on the 50th birthday, the 27th of October. There's going to be a conference in Edinburgh, which I think Dr. Allen, one of the ministers, is going to be opening or speaking at. And again, that's just an occasion to bring people together and ask those kind of questions, you know, have we fulfilled our vision of what we think our secondary school system should do? And if not, where should we be going next?
And the book is published by Trentham Books, and that's out of the Institute of Education in London, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. We chose a UK publisher because we felt that, you know, they've got things to learn from us down there. There are certain lessons that comprehensive schooling system and the experience we've had in Scotland can can give to other people for them to look at and reflect on the Scottish experience. So we've actually got contributions from England and Northern Ireland and Wales in the book as well. And these are actually very good little, they're leading academics and researchers in these countries have written little summaries for us of their different experience of developing their secondary school systems, because each of the four systems is actually now quite different. And that gives an interesting and different perspective on those questions of what is secondary schooling for and, you know, where should it be going.
And when you say about these kind of UK perspectives, Danny, one of a real sense out that I got from reading several of the chapters is that we're getting to a point now where it appears that there is greater diversity, or is likelihood of greater diversity within the Scottish education system, and you seem to contrast that with the first 50 years, or maybe just slightly less, where there was great uniformity and not much scope for other things to be tried out. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, I think Curriculum for Excellence in theory was designed to liberate a bit more local school level creativity, and my own feeling about it is that in the first 3 or 4 years we saw some of that happening. Certainly with people I was working with in schools, there was quite a lot of experiment and challenge going on in the first to third year. But I think what we've seen in the last couple of years, as usual, is that the examination system has kind of taken over, and that imposes a tremendous degree of uniformity. Having said that, you know, we do see experiments with a number of courses, with the timetabling of 4, 5, 6 and so on. And that all looks a bit diverse too at the moment. So yeah, you're probably right that internally, in terms of schools feeling a bit more empowered to make changes, there's more experiment going on. But system-wide, I think from the beginning, and certainly from the time of the Parents' Charter, the Scottish system gave a bit more license for difference. But that difference came about through the character of housing in Scotland and the placement of housing in catchment areas and through the operation of parental choice. So there's always been, I think, a degree of diversity. And the system aims to be the same, and I think our teaching force in Scotland is by and large the same in any school. It really is a national teaching force. We work to national standards. We're trained to national standards. We see ourselves as part of a profession that operates on a national basis, and our professional associations operate on a national basis in Scotland. So I think there's a lot of characteristics of the Scottish teaching profession are uniform. So despite system changes and so on, I think that gives the Scottish system a tremendously powerful sense of itself and a sense of uniformity. But I do agree also that diversity is needed. And in a way, that's just the same thing as I was saying at the beginning. It's about choice and freedom of choice, or equality and a kind of enforced system. And the Scottish system has found a different balance between these two ends of the spectrum than the English system, which seems to have gone more down the road of individuality. And the inevitable consequence of that, that we argue in the book, is that the more that you increase choice and individuality and privilege individual freedom, the more inequality will result. So you've got to find some kind of balance between these two values, between freedom and equality in your system. And particularly that's true in a schooling system where the young people involved have played no part in the unfairness or fairness of the system. You can't blame anything that happens on the way they've behaved, because they were born into this system. So there's a lot of responsibility on us as a nation to get our system right, and not just what happens in the individual schools.
And would I be right in saying that our main or most significant experience of choice, probably much less than that enacted in England, has been the parental choice in terms of placing requests?
Yeah. Well, certainly, placing requests are a big feature of the Scottish system, and as many as 1 in 5, both at entry into primary and entry into secondary. I mean, obviously, it varies year on year what the actual figures are, but the figures are all there on the web for people to see over the years. But certainly a significant proportion of youngsters are placed, and, you know, that represents quite an important value in our society, that parents should have some right of choice. And, you know, it liberated the system a little bit from a uniformity that some people resented. On the other hand, it does increase social segregation. The last proper study that was done of this in the 1990s suggested that the main reason people make the choice is not for academic reasons, but for social reasons. And, you know, that is an underlying factor in the Scottish system, yeah.
I'll just say at this point, Danny, that if listeners are listening to the live stream, you can get in touch with a comment or question for Danny in the next 20 minutes or so. You can email edutalker, that's edutalkr, at hotmail.co.uk, or if you're on Twitter, you can just pop something up there and include the hashtag edutalk. Now, maybe for the benefit of some of our Scottish-based listeners, but very much for our international audience, Danny, can you take us back to where the comprehensive system of schooling in Scotland, where it was born, and what were the kind of economic and social conditions that gave rise to its birth?
Well, I think there's two or three things to say there briefly, David, and you know, as a kind of brief outline of the background. The first is that there always had been a degree of comprehensiveness in the Scottish school system, if you like, based around the meritocratic principle that it didn't matter where you came from. If you had academic worth and value and you had ability, you could rise to the top. And, you know, that was a feature of the old parish schools going back to the, you know, the middle of the 19th century and further back. And it was a feature that carried through right until the present day. I think the meritocratic principle is still a strong principle in Scotland, that if you have academic talent, there should be nothing stands in your way of making the most of it. But, you know, it's become clear in all developed societies in the 20th century that you shouldn't just develop those who had academic talent. Every child deserves to have their talents identified and developed. And not everybody has the same academic abilities, but everybody has great abilities which can contribute greatly to society and can be enhanced. And so in the 20th century, the thinking behind that, you know, with people like Dewey and so on, developed, and there was a strong educationist and social and political drive that selecting children at age 11 was selecting out of further progress some youngsters who were not going to get as good a deal. They were going to go to schools, some of which were very good schools where people were working very hard, but which were clearly seen as and identified as second best, and almost there was no way back. Well, in the 1950s, that began to change a bit in Scotland. There were experiments with comprehensive schools in some of the local authorities. Glasgow, for example, in the 1950s, decided that any new schools being built would be comprehensive schools and that there would not be a selective intake. And also in the rural areas, there always had been, to some extent, what were called then omnibus schools. So these were schools where you might have a junior secondary and a senior secondary in the same building. So even though some children had failed, they were in the same building as the children who had passed the examination or test at 11 plus. And they could, if they showed potential in second and third year at secondary, they could jump into the other stream, if you like. So you've got all these things coming together, and a lot of political argument in the early 1960s, because at that time, when selection was still very much a feature of the system, some of those senior secondaries had developed a tremendous culture and tradition around them, and people were very attached to them because they'd gone to school with them, they'd given them their start in life, they were former pupils who really valued the school they'd gone, wanted their children to go to the same school, have the same education. Quite understandably, they were now prominent figures in the legal profession or in teaching or somewhere else, and they really valued those old senior secondary schools. So some of those people fought rearguard actions against comprehensivisation, but when the Labour government came in 1964, largely on the basis of arguments in England, about the tripartite system in England, the national UK-wide government had already decided, the new Labour government had decided one of its key priorities was going to be to abolish the 11 plus, as it was called in England, abolish selection for secondary school and ensure that every child had access to the same high level of education. So that was the kind of background, you know, in Scotland. We were influenced internationally, we were influenced by England, but we also had our own tradition. But that was the challenge that was set to us. I mean, I started teaching in 1974 in the East End of Glasgow, and you know, we were very much in the early days. And the challenge was, can we provide an education that develops every child to the fullest of their potential and creates an atmosphere within the school where people can learn with and from each other and where every child is equally valued? And that's been the challenge of the last 50 years, and it's been a kind of up and down rocky road sometimes, but I think by and large the teaching profession has done a great job in responding to that challenge, and we're much further down that road now than we were in 1965. But there's still a way to go.
So the story is kind of characterised as striving to meet these democratic values of liberty, equality and fraternity, but kind of recognising early on that we weren't quite there, but it's a journey that I think we're well on the road to now. You talk about the exam system, and my reading of one of the chapters when it's kind of referring, you know, the changes right through to the new nationals, sounded to me as if the advent of standard grade was a real kind of step change in terms of, I suppose, equality of access for young people, or valuing everybody within a school community.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the standard grade did provide, and again, this is something that can only be done system-wide. You know, it needs a national, local authorities can't do this on their own, schools can't do this on their own. These kind of changes have to be done at national level, and it needs a degree of national vision and so on to make these kind of things happen. So the introduction of standard grade was a very significant moment, or, you know, it took 10 years, of course, so it was more than a moment in the story of our schooling, because it represented, at least in one sense, a way in which we were going to value all youngsters equally, because all of them would have access to a kind of national level qualification that said, yeah, you've reached a standard grade. However, I would argue, and, you know, David Rafe and I in the chapter on governance argue that we've still got a way to go before we get to equal value of all children's talents. You know, we have a system at the moment that certainly grades children in terms of their academic merit, but we don't provide any kind of pat on the back when children are leaving about the other good things that they do or have done on a national basis. I mean, we may do that in little bits and pieces of ways, the Duke of Edinburgh Award, the John Muir Award, school certificates of civic service. You know, there's lots of little bits and pieces that we do in each school to say to youngsters who are leaving school, you know, you've made something of yourself, you've achieved this, you've done well here. And, you know, certainly we argue in the book that there's a need for us to look at whether we don't need to have some kind of better way of recognising on a systematic national basis, without the grading, the invidious grading that can sometimes devalue children's feeling of achievement in the examination system, to recognise the broader set of values we've set for our system. After all, Curriculum for Excellence set out these four broad aims of what every educated Scot would have as their kind of characteristics, their capacities, their abilities when they left school. And yet at the end of secondary school, we're only really, you know, saying, certificating and recognising one of those, and even then only part of that, which is the successful learner bit. So the academic still kind of dominates, I think, in the way that we think about our schooling and what it's for.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot more than just deliver academic value, schooling is also at the heart of our community, and it's the first place where our young people meet what society, how society works and what it thinks about people. And it's got to be, we've got to have a system where every youngster is valued equally.
And when you talk about towards the end of the book about lessons learned for the Scottish system of schooling, you know, you talk about a comprehensive system should be clear about the knowledge, skills and understanding it expects all of its learners to develop. Now, you and the other authors are fairly critical in certain parts of the book about CFE in terms of where we're at just now, and you do recognise that there's been insufficient research across the system. But as we stand just now, Danny, you know, would you say that CFE is clear to all the participants, all the stakeholders, about the expectations for learners to develop during the 3 to 18 phase?
No, I don't think so. I mean, that's my personal view, obviously, but, you know, the four editors, we all had our own individual bits and pieces on that. But I think Curriculum for Excellence was quite clear about the broad thrust of education, that it should be about more than just academic progress. And I think certainly in primary schools in Scotland, that's been the case, you know, very really rubber stamped what so many of our excellent primaries do. But in the secondary sector, there's always the danger that the examination tail wags the curriculum dog, as we used to say, and importance of examinations are, they're not and shouldn't be the only thing that has importance in secondary school education, or indeed broadly in secondary education. And one of the points we make in the book is that while we've tried to deliver on comprehensive schooling, we maybe haven't sufficiently in Scotland given attention to comprehensive education, because we know that after age 16, a substantial proportion of our youngsters get their education somewhere else. And whereas in England, and I think England in this respect is ahead of us, England for the last couple of years now has identified age 18 as the final year of full-time education, albeit that education can take place in a variety of different places, in a college and so on. Work placement, work learning placements and so on. In Scotland we still have this kind of uncertainty. The school leaving age is 16, but that means Christmas for some and summer for some. The ones that leave, unlike those who stay on, who generally have quite a clear and well understood progression into their 17 and 18 years old, the ones who leave have a myriad cluster of different kinds of opportunities which only expert careers advisors seem to know about, and certainly their parents generally don't know about. And I think that is an unequal position, because people in society in general, many more people should know what are they doing for all youngsters aged 16 to 18. There is a lot on offer, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of opportunities. There's the learning guarantee and so on, and the recent emphasis on positive destinations after school is very, very, very welcome. But on the other hand, it's hard to understand the diversity of things that go on outside of school up to age 18. And a better, more coherent framework than senior phase offered us. I mean, senior phase, I suppose, would be the main area I'm critical of Curriculum for Excellence. It seems to me very much under-designed, in that we could have constructed a system for pulling together whether a youngster was in college or in a work learning placement or in school, a kind of framework that still kept the principles of Curriculum for Excellence in its design. I think there's work still to be done there, and we argue that in the book, and I argued it in the book I published last year called Schooling Scotland and the Postcards from Scotland series. I had more freedom as an individual to go on my own line on that one, and I certainly was arguing that we need some kind of graduation certificate in Scotland that builds on the P7 profile and the S3 profile, and values not just what end users want you know, whether it's universities or whoever, but values what children bring to the table as well and what they've got, you know, young carers and people who are talented in sport. And, you know, let's harness and pull together and give an equal value to the kind of tremendous contribution that every youngster can make to our communities and our society.
And in terms of getting things right in the future, do you feel there's an important role for the Scottish educational research community and others? You know, this kind of, you talk about independent scrutiny, you know, to maybe help things along, something in addition to, you know, the big reports of OECD, etc.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think the OECD report, by the way, they recommended a Scottish graduate certificate as well. You may remember that. But I think these external evaluations do have an important place. And I know that there's research commissioned on curriculum for excellence, and I'd be interested to see what comes out of that. In particular, I'd like to see them look at curriculum structures in the senior phase and how successful these are in promoting equality, because one of the dangers of creating, you know, letting a thousand flowers bloom, as Mao said in the late 50s in China, is you create so much diversity that nobody knows what's going on. And in that situation, your target of creating equality can go backwards because you don't have the information to know. And typically when nobody knows what's going on, at the micro level, the one set of people that do know what's going on are the advantaged classics, people like us, people who have got degrees, who have been through the system, who understand how the system works and who can still find ways to promote and support our children, no matter what the school system's doing. So diversity has its strengths, but it also has its weaknesses. And where we have this more diverse system, it's all the more important that we keep a handle on it, not just in terms of the numbers, but also in terms of the quality of what's happening. Now, I'm bound here to mention Education Scotland and the Inspectorate, who have had that responsibility. But I think for me, their very narrow focus on the performance of schools, or certainly that was the focus from the mid-90s, when they kind of bought into the kind of model that was down in England. I think that had really distracted them from what I see as one of their primary responsibilities, which is to comment on the operation of the system. And, you know, that means asking questions like, are 32 local authorities the right bodies? You know, it's 32 different forms of diversity, you know, given the budget struggles local authorities are having and so on. I'm not saying there should be elected representatives locally in charge of education, but should there be 32 local authorities when there's, what is it, 12 or 13 health boards and 13 or 14 college boards? And we're talking about integrating the work between health education and further education and school education. You know, the whole set of decisions that need to be made at national level deserve to be scrutinised and examined, and that examination put into the public sphere so that citizens can discuss these issues and make the right choices, you know, in terms of policies for our politicians to take forward. And at the moment, there's a fantastic gap of information on these kind of issues. Typically, the issues that come up in the media are very reactive. You know, it's to do with individual incidents or what particular politicians have had to say. And unless you've got a well-developed research community which can provide some kind of independent scrutiny and provide information that answers the right kind of questions, you're not going to get that level of knowledge in the civic community about how the system operates. So, yes, that's a long-winded way of answering your question. But, yes, I think that at present, relying on individual inspection reports in individual schools and then occasional little bits of studies, you know, that's not good. I'm going to give you a very good example with my colleagues who worked with me on the book. For many, many years, they were some of the leading figures in the Centre for Educational Sociology at the University of Edinburgh. And one of the things that they had responsibility for and published on there's a thing called the Scottish School Leavers Survey. Every year, a statistically representative sample of children in Scotland leaving school were surveyed about their experience of school. Now, that survey was stopped about 10 or 12 years ago and redesigned and lost its potency because it was a very, very powerful body of knowledge about what the children themselves had to say about their own experience of schooling. And it had quite a big impact on the profession and on policy over the years. I mean, you maybe remember in the book we quote one of the famous publications that came out of that survey in the early 1980s, a book called Tell Them From Me, where children in the pre-standard grade era who left school without any qualifications bemoaned their experience of schooling in that time because they felt that the teachers neglected them and only paid attention to the children who were going for low grades. So the voice of the pupils, which is, you know, so important, and it's going to be even more important when you get to vote in the elections for their councillors. You know, these 16 and 17-year-olds are going to be able to vote while they're still sitting in school. And yet we can't capture their voice and their experience of schooling. So these are the kinds of bits of knowledge that the civic community needs if we're going to make the best decisions for the future. So yes, I very much agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, that really struck me, Danny, as a senior teacher in my school. I'm involved in school council and kind of looking at programmes of study with young people and getting them to talk about what they've enjoyed, what they haven't enjoyed, how a teacher might enhance, you know, a unit of work, for example. And I was really drawn to that chapter of the book where, you know, you're actually, okay, you're, you know, talking 20, 30, 40 years ago, but... you know, verbatim the experiences of some young people who felt they had achieved and been included, and those who hadn't. And I don't know, playing devil's advocate, I was just not brave enough with the curriculum reform over the last 10 or 12 years to actually ask young people to tell us how it is now.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I think the teachers do. I think you're right, David, that over the past 20, 25 years, teachers using pupil views to evaluate the classroom, and I mean, let's face it, you know, you can't get 40 minutes in a classroom before you know the pupil's views nowadays, so you know, you're all constantly taking it on board when you're in the classroom, just because of the character of young people today. They won't sit silent if you know, they think there's something you're doing that's not meeting their needs. So but that's not getting captured nationally. That's not the form our system nationally. So I agree, yes, I think we should be giving a place for young people's voices, definitely.
And just finally, Danny, I know we've overrun, and it's just the first show of the series. You know, what kind of response have you and your fellow editors received since publication?
Well, it's been the school. We made the mistake of publishing in the middle of June, so... I don't think anybody was taking it away for holiday reading, but I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get a wee head of steam up about it running up to the 50th anniversary. And I'd like to think we could get a good going discussion in our professional communities. I'm at the conference in October, for example, Larry Flanagan, the EIS General Secretary, is speaking, but also in our civic communities. You know, maybe, you know, we'll manage to get place an article in the Scotsman or the Herald or the Press and Journal or the Dundee Courier or some local papers here and there about the anniversary, and just get a bit of discussion going on the kind of issues that you've been asking me about, issues that really lie underneath the day-to-day details of, you know, this school's getting closed, or, you know, that school's getting a new head teacher, or, you know, this other school has, you know, had a bad inspection report. You know, or even, you know, what's happening with higher maths. These are all important things in the shorter term, but sometimes when you step back and look at the longer term, you get that better overview of, you know, what are the really big issues here about the character of our secondary schooling system and what it's doing for Scotland and what it could do for Scotland. And you know, we're trying with the book and with the celebration of the anniversary to stimulate a debate around those sort of questions. So, yeah, so far, summer holidays will let people off. But I think once we come back to it in the autumn, and schools are coming back now this week and beginning of next week in some places, hopefully that debate will pick up, David. And thank you very much for the invitation and the chance to raise these issues this evening in this programme.
Well, thank you so much, Danny, for taking time out this evening to appear on Radio Edutalk, and best wishes for the future and with the promotion of the book and indeed the forthcoming event.
Thank you very much indeed, David. Thank you.